Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
This is part two of an ongoing conversation that I'm having, I think, with Karen Doherty. She's a psychotherapist. She's a filmmaker. She's someone who has a lot to say about a whole lot of things. And we have a little bit of fun in this as well. And I'm convinced that Karen's going to be writing a book soon. And she's not sure what it's about yet. But this will be an ongoing, I think, conversation we're going to have for some time. She believes that, quote, understanding your feelings and behaviors is the first step towards making positive, lasting change, to rediscovering your authentic self, and to developing true resilience, close quote. We talk about feelings and about babies and about infant communication. We talk about poetry and William Blake and about certainty and uncertainty and about existential angst. We get into a whole lot of different topics in this conversation, and I trust that you will see it through. Karen is an interesting guest and an engaging conversationalist, and somebody that I'm having the pleasure of getting to know a little bit more through a variety of different ways. And so Karen Doherty is coming right up. DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my own podcasting, writing, and also you can help support Face to Face through Patreon.com. And don't forget Rabble.ca too for more information about other podcasts, not only myself, but others as well. Stay tuned for Karen Doherty. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a returning guest today. Karen Doherty is here with us today to talk about a whole lot of things, I think. And for those of you who have listened to our conversation, a year ago now, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
It might even be longer. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure.
And you're going to tell us where you're coming from just this morning, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Friday mornings, I do what for me is part of my training, which is infant observation. So as a candidate in psychoanalysis and as a therapist, infant observation is so helpful. Mm-hmm. I don't work with children. I don't work with babies. But I go once a week to see this baby in the family. And this is from before the baby was born. So the baby now is 4 months old.
When you say the family, a family or your family?
Not my family.
Okay.
A family. And I go, I've been going once every week for 1 hour, and I go and I observe.
Hmm.
And I've been watching the baby from in utero, basically, to now. And the baby, how the baby is in the family, how the baby's mind unfolds, the interactions in the family, the baby's role in the family. It's been so helpful. And it's particularly helpful for me right now, not just in my own practice, but because I'm working on another film with Beatrice Beebe, we spoke about the mm-hmm. film that I was working on last time, which is done and sort of online. We're working on another film now about infant research and adult treatment. So the implications of what we know from watching babies, from our infant research, and how we can extrapolate what we can use from that observation of a mother and a baby in adult treatment. So there are a whole bunch of things that
So are you saying, Karen, that if had I been more well observed as a kid, I'd be more well balanced today?
I am not saying that.
There'd be new forms of treatment?
No, not saying it. No, I mean, I don't think the baby's benefiting from my observation because it's not an intervention. I'm just watching.
Right. So with the hope of intervening
in an
adult's life at some point. Or no?
In an adult's life?
So the idea being, obviously, I suppose as an experiment on its own, it's probably valuable. I would imagine the data that you'd probably draw from that. But is the idea that that would then help, not this particular person,
no,
but
yeah.
might help others from this kind of, you say, you know, infant research and adult treatment?
Yeah, so basically, you know, it all starts there, right, in the first few months of life, like how we learn to relate, how we learn, what the expectations that we come to have of our relationships.
It's a great line. It right? all starts there.
It all starts, it does.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
And that's what Beatrice Beebe's work at Columbia shows us. She's been watching mothers and infants interact for 40 years. She's been filming it and then doing the frame-by-frame analysis of the dyadic interactions. And she can predict from 2.5 minutes of face-to-face play, as we discussed, the attachment style of an infant at 1 year. And from 1 year, we can predict the attachment style in young adults. So if it's going to be a secure attachment or one of the types of insecure attachment, anxious or, you know, sort of the different types of anxious attachment. So I happen to be observing a very secure family, which is quite delightful for me and sometimes a bit painful too, you know, to see it go so beautifully and so well.
Right.
Can be painful.
I guess, yeah, as a therapist over the years, I guess you've seen some pretty difficult situations and you kind of want to... put that up on the screen for people to watch, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Say, this is, you know, it's so funny. So, have you seen Logan yet?
No.
I don't know if you're a superhero fan in any way, shape, or form.
I am.
But Logan is a real shift away. And there is a moment, and now that I've mentioned it, I won't say any more, but there is a moment where there's an aha moment for the Wolverine. And he goes, wow, this is what it's meant to be like. It's really, I'm getting shivers actually. Like it's a beautiful moment.
This is how it could be.
This is how it could be.
Which is a moment of mourning.
It really is.
And it's such an important thing for all of us to do. And that's one of the things we're trying to help our patients do is sort of mourn the loss, right? Of how, of the hope that it could have been different, right? That it could be different. And it can be different for people, but the past can't be different, right? The past can't be different.
No, you can't. You can't do anything about it. That's for sure. That's what you mean, right? Like you can't. You can't go back and change it. Is what you're suggesting.
You can't go back and change it. But what you can do, really, when I'm talking about the implications of infant research on adult treatment, I'm actually talking about the way that we sit with a patient. It's not so much you're thinking, oh, what happened to this person in their babyhood. That's certainly part of what. You know, treatment, but you can't really ever know what you can, you know, you can find out certain kinds of data, but we're not making a documentary film about the person, right? We're trying to understand what it means for that person to be in a relationship and what goes wrong for them in relationships very often. So really it's about how to be with someone. So you're thinking about how mothers are with babies and how they tune into their babies. How they hold their babies mentally, how they hold their babies in mind, how they give space, the nonverbal communication, so body language, space, silence, all that stuff, sounds. Those are the things that we learn from watching mothers and babies, because mothers and babies and patients and therapists, right? Therapists and patients have a lot in common in terms of their way of relating. I think we talked last time about face-to-face,
with
the name
absolutely.
Of your, and how looking and looking away, which is the subject of the last film that I did, is very important. Like, we need to look away to downregulate. Babies do, and we all do. And it's the only time that you can really kind of keep someone's gaze for longer than a few seconds, 6 to 8 seconds before looking away,
right,
is if you're making love or fighting, or if you're a mother with your baby, or if you're a therapist with your patient.
Hmm.
So therapists and mothers have that in common. They can look without looking away.
Interesting degrees of intimacy.
Mm-hmm. It is about intimacy.
In very different contexts.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It is about intimacy, but also can be intrusive.
Right.
So, and overstimulating. And so how to give people the space while you're looking. People need to look away. Some patients can't look at all. That's why the couch can be very helpful.
Is this why supposedly, and that's capital S, I think, boys, men are supposed to be able to talk more when they're driving in a car because they don't actually have to look at each other?
Yes.
They're constantly looking away?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. I must have read that recently or something. Mm-hmm. As my son gets a bit older and my daughter, I mean, it's becoming more, not of an issue, but just more of a highlight, I think, for Elizabeth and I as we try to parent well.
Mm.
And try to continue to develop intimacy and dialogue, you know, with our kids and an openness and an authenticity, I guess, right?
Well, you know, just even doing a thought experiment, so you're asking your daughter a question and you're looking at her. You're looking at her and you're saying, how was school today? Versus you're looking away,
right,
and looking at the ceiling or looking at a detail and asking her, which is she more likely to be able to answer? Actually, the one where you're looking away. Because you're giving her the space and you're
right,
not...
Right.
There's a kind of a pressure, I think, sometimes when you're looking at someone and asking a direct question. It can feel almost aggressive or intrusive.
Right.
Whereas
right.
if you're looking away, even if they're looking at you, they have a little bit of space.
Yeah, you know? You would probably never correct anyone or a child or a coworker or something by looking away. It would be way more.
Yes.
Hey, would you look at me when I'm talking to you?
Yes. Right? Yeah. Look
yeah.
at me when I'm talking to you is the unspoken thing sometimes
yes.
when
yeah.
you're looking at someone.
Sure.
Yeah.
So then in this infinite observation, you're learning things about how we behave with others, really, isn't it?
Yes. I'm seeing a securely attached dyad. In other words, I'm seeing a good mother, good enough
right.
mother,
right.
Who's not overly intrusive with her baby. And it's just fascinating. It's a fascinating thing to, I mean, I'm not a mother.
Yeah.
So even if I were, I mean, I have classmates in my infant observation class who are parents, but they're still getting a lot out of observing a mother and an infant from the time that before the infant is born to see how we learn to be with an other. Because it goes both ways, the baby-mother relationship. Of course, it's much more the mother, but the baby also brings stuff to the table. The baby might be an extra sensitive being, like sensorially, or the baby might have, you know, acid reflux or colic, or you know, there are all kind or whatever developmental
yeah.
disability. So babies bring something to the table, right? And so the back and forth, the dyadic interchange, what are you going to do when I do this? And if the baby can figure it out, if the baby knows what to expect, when I do this, you do this. Then you have the beginnings of a securely attached individual. But if they can't predict what the other is, what the mom is going to do, if I do this, I don't know what mom's going to do, that's the beginning of an insecurely attached dyad.
How much of this do you think happens before the baby is born? You know, the whole, you know, listening to music. And,
oh,
you know,
I don't
the,
know.
The attitudes of the mother, you know, the sense of humor. How is, you know, is that make a difference, do you think?
You're asking me nature versus nurture.
Yeah, I am. That's exactly what I just wrote down. I want to get to nature and nurture.
I don't know
yeah.
how much is...
And how can we really,
We
right?
can't, but we know that it's both nature
yeah.
and nurture.
Yeah.
And we know this from twin studies, where we've got one, you know, two identical twins raised in totally different homes.
Right.
In different environments. And yet they have the same proclivities in certain areas, or they move in the same way, or they laugh in the same way. And that can't have been learned from their environment.
Right.
So, but how much? Right. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think for, I don't know, is this a fair sort of, not a conclusion, but an observation, I suppose, from your, you know, doing an infant observation. It's just for me as a parent and as I hope a thoughtful friend and human being, it really is important to be aware of everything we do.
Yeah.
I mean, everything counts, right? Every facial expression, every handshake, and every hug of your child.
I think that sounds like anxiety to me, what you just said, because it's not everyone that counts. It's the preponderance.
Right.
It's not. So it's the reason that 2.5 minutes of face-to-face play for Beatrice can predict, you know, the attachment style is because there's so many repetitions in that 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
Of certain ways of relating. And so it's not that one traumatic moment or one no or one, you know, temper tantrum by the parent is going to permanently scar the child. It's layers upon layers. It's, you know, many, 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 many. Mm-hmm.
I grew up with my mother used to speak to my brother and I through little signs and notes that were on the fridge without actually, you know, speaking to us about them, but would put these things up, and we knew that they were really for us, you know, words of wisdom and warnings and things.
Warnings.
I think so. But one of them was everything we do affects someone else. And I think was sort of the thought I had that, you know, be mindful of how we engage with others, how we interact.
Yeah, it's so important.
Yeah. And that every sort of thing matters in a way. You know, certainly every interaction seems to matter. Even, you know, grabbing a coffee at the local Starbucks, you know, maybe not. I don't know.
It can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you say it can, you mean sort of not necessarily relevant.
Yeah. I mean, I think where my mind is going from what you're saying is, you know,
treat others well.
You treat others well. Yeah. We're on autopilot so much, right?
Right. Right.
And so, but we can actually have encounters through the day that do make other people feel better and us feel better.
Right. It's just smile.
Yeah.
Right? I guess maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's that in itself.
Hey, listen, I don't practice it. So.
But then I think about all the times, you know, women are told to smile. But I think it's be genuine. Be present.
Yeah, sure.
Sort of as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know, but don't tell yourself that you need to be present.
Right,
you know,
I
like
see.
Don't put
yes.
pressure
hence
on yourself. Hence the anxiety.
Right, like, good.
You
yeah.
know, sort of like yeah, allow you yourself to
I'm
be.
I'm not suggesting you have to always be up or anything like that. In fact, that's frankly a little nauseous for me when you meet folks that are constantly up.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's not authentic.
It doesn't
it can't
seem to be.
It can't be.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, when is that a symptom?
Right.
When is that
right.
a defense?
Right.
So you can kind of feel it qualitatively
right.
when someone
right.
is kind of like, you know what I'm talking
I
about.
I do, yeah.
Sort of like artificially up. And that can itself be an indication that there's something that they can't be feeling right now. And then you respect that, but at the same time, it doesn't feel genuine maybe, or, you know, you're not really connecting with that person.
Could you say that, and I don't think I asked you this the last time around, but could you say that our mental health issues, our, you know, psychotherapeutic issues can be sort of, not reduced, that's the wrong way to put it, but are connected to how we play with others, how we work with others, how we deal with others? Is, you know, it's how we interact. It comes down to a relational question.
I think so. I think it does often come down to how we relate. Relational. I like your word play.
Yeah.
Actually, I know you were using it playfully.
Yes.
But I think it is about the ability to play. Yeah. The ability to, you know, I can't remember who said it, but the idea that therapy is kind of bringing someone from a state of not being able to play to being able to play, you know, and it can be that, right? Yeah, I think it all comes down to relationships, I think. Yes.
which then...
Including with ourselves.
Right.
So
right.
our relationship right. with the other, our relationship with romantic partners, our relationship with friends, with family, with the world, with work, and with ourselves. Yeah.
So I was with someone very recently who I would describe as totally not self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also a part of this conversation for, I don't even know if you would use a phrase like good mental health or balanced. I'm not even sure that...
You might say not psychologically minded.
Right.
But without specifics, I couldn't...
right.
But that's the phrase that pops into my mind.
Yeah, and I use that very, very carefully too, in a sense, because I'm not so sure I'm balanced, right? And I'm not even sure I like the notion of balance in a way, because to me it sort of speaks of mediocrity, on a certain level.
It's funny, we were just talking before you turned the microphone on, but we were talking about this book that I picked up, which is Peter Ackroyd's biography of Blake from a million years ago, but... I hadn't read it yet, and I love William Blake, in part because, I mean, this is a man who, you know, was maybe not the picture of what we would consider mental health today, but one of the greatest poets in the English language, in part because he believed that you kind of had to go to another place to be creative. He called it eternity, basically. So we live in generation. Mathematicians live in this other place that's sort of hell. He called it Ulro. He had names for everything. Hmm. Beulah is this sort of heavenly place where we kind of frolic about in this field. But then eternity is where the poets have to go. And that's sort of like the universe and, you know, kind of like this crazy heavenly place. And he went there. He would go there. It's beyond heaven. It's where all creativity sort of happens, right? Like artistic creativity. Yeah. Yeah. So normal or balanced is great most of the time, but sometimes we have to go to another place. We have to go to an altered state. We have to dream. We have to play. Yeah.
Well, and I wonder too, if that's actually where, and I would imagine Blake would agree, where discovery really happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where leaps forward happen.
Creative
leaps. Disruptions happen. Yeah, creative disruptions, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, corporately or in a school setting or writing a poem. Mm-hmm. You've got to have that sense. I mean, it's the guy I did, Michael Polanyi, I wrote my master's thesis on. He was a scientist who became a philosopher, and I'm sure some of my listeners have heard me talk about him before, but he wrote a book called Personal Knowledge. And the whole idea was that here is this chemist who comes to philosophy late in his life and said, hang on a second here, that's not how we do science. The way we talk about how we do science is not how we do science. We do science in a community. Mm. We rub shoulders. We rub elbows. Mm-hmm. We're very inexact. In fact, one of the first articles he ever wrote was called The Value of the Inexact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where discovery happens.
Mm-hmm.
When you're not so focused on, say, the experiment.
Systematization.
Yeah, and you're in the community. He called it conviviality, which I think is a beautiful way to talk about it.
That's nice.
And we're talking about it, and all of a sudden, I get it. Things come together because I've been living the language and living the life, I guess, as it were. Mm-hmm. And maybe as human beings, maybe it is really, maybe play is that place.
Yes, and I want to just say on behalf of Blake that when he talks about Ulro and sort of mathematicians, that's where they live, he doesn't mean creative mathematicians.
Mm.
He means people who are sort of poring over exactitude, and he's really kind of almost talking about, what we would think of as the most caricatured accountant who's counting money, so that's really what he's talking about. He's saying if you don't give yourself room, if you don't give yourself play, then you're not going to have a good life. That's what he's talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And is that, can we make this really practical now and go work-life balance?
It's so funny for me to think of that term in concert with William Blake.
Yes. No, it doesn't.
Because I don't think he did have work-life balance.
Sure
he worked
did.
All the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, when you're talking about balance, what does it mean for you? And I think one of the most important things as a therapist for me is to help people say what they mean by the words that are that resonate for them, because you'll find that people have buzzwords, but it doesn't mean for them what it means for you.
Yeah, sure.
And so to get people to kind of speak their personal poetry, is really important. Nice. And that's really what you're helping people to do, maybe, is to put things into words for what might be the first time, some unformulated experience mm-hmm. or something that they don't quite understand, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you're mm-hmm. helping them to do.
You spend a lot of time asking questions?
No. Absolutely not.
No,
absolutely. Okay. And it's funny because we were talking about questions earlier,
yeah.
right? And
yeah,
I said,
yeah.
okay, so we ask Elizabeth, your daughter, a direct question.
Right.
What does she
yeah.
do? I don't know. Fine. Okay.
Right.
Whatever. Right?
Right. Yeah.
But also, questions don't necessarily lead to answers.
Mm.
And answers are not cures for questions. And so I help people to find out what their questions are for themselves, but to ask someone a question can be very aggressive or intrusive or leading, or it can feel like a criticism. It can, you know, there are many reasons not to. I mean, that doesn't mean that I'm not interrogative
right.
in my approach, but, and I'll do a lot of this. You know, so
right.
as an analyst, you don't
sure,
say
sure.
a lot, but, asking a direct question is often more about me and my own curiosity, getting that sated, than about sort of helping the patient find their own answers.
So it's about space.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ben, and we did talk about, I think, listening last
space
time a fair bit. And that,
to play.
Oh, I got to be honest with you. I think whenever I shut down face-to-face, whenever I stop doing the podcast, which I hope won't be for quite some time, I'm coming up on 300 interviews, little plug
wow.
there. but it really is about listening. And I got a wonderful compliment just a couple days ago. Wow, David, you let your guests speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I, that was great for me, because I think as a development worker, as a philosopher, I think it, you know, we want to give people the answers.
Mm.
Oh, here, I've got the program for your community.
Mm.
This is going to sort everything out. It's it's going to make sense for you, you know, or whatever. As a parent, I think we're uncomfortable, right? I think one of the biggest complaints I heard about Manchester by the Sea, you know, the Oscar winner, was it didn't end.
Mm.
Well, it did end, but it didn't go anywhere. And well,
people don't like uncertainty.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You know, so why didn't it resolve? You know, and even I kind of thought we were used to that now. Aren't we postmoderns?
No. We like certainty. Uncertainty makes us uncomfortable,
yeah.
and it's sort
yeah.
of the only certainty.
Right.
And
yeah. Yeah.
So that's the other, you know, sort of part of therapy or analysis is, you know, allowing people to kind of get to a place where they're more comfortable with being uncertain. And sometimes people will come in and they'll say, I don't know what I think about anything. And my response to that is, that's an excellent place to start. Because if you come in feeling like you do know about something, really, like you do know what's going on, chances are we've got to get you out of that rigid thinking to
right.
another narrative.
Right.
You know,
right.
so when people come in not knowing, it's actually a better starting place sometimes than knowing. Yeah.
Do you think... you know, answer this however, and I know you will, but do you think the majority of your clients, your patients, your friends, throw me in here, are looking for solutions? So I've done enough therapy over the years, you know, marital and singles and all these different types of counseling and so on. When you walk through the door, are you hoping for that? Okay, David, here's what you need. Here are the three things you need to do. You know, because we see that so much, right?
I think some people do come in saying, you know, I'm unhappy, I don't know why, and my goal is to be happy in sort of 10 sessions or less. That's a bit of a caricature,
right.
but...
Which would be cognitive-based therapy in a way, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah,
it's like to retrain yourself. Here's how you retrain yourself.
Yeah, CBT can be good for some habits, although
right.
it's habit-forming in some ways because you need to come back.
right.
But... you know, in fact, the modality that I do and the reason that I love it so much, psychodynamic psychotherapy or psychoanalytic psychotherapy or psychoanalysis, is that it doesn't give people answers. It gives people the tools to find their own answers, to question
right.
themselves, to query themselves, to stop themselves in a certain moment and say, okay, what's going on for me here? Why am I having an overblown reaction to this? Oh, yeah, it's this thing. That's a lifelong...
Mm-hmm.
ability. That's a skill. set that you're helping someone. That's a function that you're helping someone internalize, the function of being a person who holds the space in a certain way to allow certain kinds of thinking to take place that, you know, that hasn't taken place. So, yes, people come in, they say, can you help me in 10 sessions or less? And I say, I don't work that way. Mm. I want people who come to me who've Googled existential despair, basically.
Right.
Therapist right. plus therapist plus Toronto. That's what, you
plus
know,
or Camus. I'm currently reading The Myth of Sisyphus. Can you help me?
Right. Yeah. That's sort of my ideal patient. That doesn't mean that I don't see people who have all different kinds of issues. And
so you want a degree of authenticity before almost.
Isn't that interesting?
I think that's what I'm hearing.
I will work with people who maybe aren't as psychologically minded as we're talking about to perhaps help them to become more so. But it's not really my expertise.
Right.
My expertise is in a certain way of listening to a certain kind of suffering. And so part of the journey for me in becoming a therapist is knowing my own limitations, knowing when it's time to send somebody, like, because I do free consults. Like, I see people at no charge, and then we will either decide to work together because it feels good, or I will send them to someone who I believe in.
Right.
I will say, you know what, I don't know anyone with that particular area of expertise, so here's what I suggest.
Right.
And help people. That's where my research background comes in handy, right?
Sure.
But yeah, knowing my own limitations, knowing the patients who are who will benefit most from what I bring to the table. Yeah.
I think I live a pretty healthy life. I think I'm fairly balanced, whatever that means. And you know, everyone now knows I don't like the word. But relatively decent family, good family, great family. Active, read, you know, lots of interesting variables in my life. But there's things that really still bother me, you know, from a mental health perspective. I don't like being lonely. I still feel lonely from time to time, right? Mm. And so I think what I'm hearing is that that's okay.
That's
right?
Okay.
It's totally okay. This is the way kind of it is supposed to be.
That's part of human experience.
That's part of who we are. So don't come looking for that one book or two books, or you know, you're going to find it through the poetry of William Blake, and through conversation and owning pets and things,
and also sometimes being alone
and
I think that's the other thing that people find helpful about therapy, the kind of therapy that I do, is, you know, a lot of people are told from a very early age, maybe not explicitly, but you know, implicitly or non-verbally, that their feelings are bad.
Right.
So that it's bad to be afraid, it's bad to be sad, it's bad to be mad. Only mommy can be mad. Only mommy can, you know. And so people think, oh my God, I'm sad. It's awful. I have to stop this. It's terrible. Something's really wrong.
Yep.
As opposed to, okay, our emotions are important data, really important data, to tell us about what's going on in the world around us or in us. And we need them. We want them. We want the full spectrum. We don't want just a little slice, you know? And you know, can you imagine? Like, I know people do, but can you imagine being happy all the time? I mean, I'm just exhausted thinking about it. You know, like,
funny.
And it's not even possible. It's not even possible.
I think that sounds like a bumper sticker campaign to me. Dot, dot, dot. For more information, please call. That's very, can you imagine being happy all the time?
The happiness anti-happy hotline.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting you say, you know, searching existential angst, you know, those. I'm pretty sure most existentialists would say that a lot of our issues are the fact that we aren't rooted enough in others. Right? The whole idea of getting to know ourselves is through others and how we interact. And I don't mean that in a negative way at all. I mean, it's totally positive, total, like the mirror, right?
And
also the look comes into play as well, which is really interesting.
Well, and it goes right back to what we learned from babies. And the baby learns what it feels. It learns what's going on inside. It learns who it is, what it is, through the mother's face, through the mother's reflection of itself. So if the mother's face, facial expression, sort of matches, not an exact match, but sort of plays with the baby, it's called cross-modal matching, sort of plays with the baby's emotions, or, you know, the woe face that mother gives back to baby when baby's sad.
Right.
Baby goes, oh, I'm sad. Oh, that's what I'm feeling.
Interesting.
And people who haven't had that kind of mirroring have a really hard time being with the other, looking even at the other.
Cross-modal matching, did you
call it? Cross-modal matching, yeah.
So it's almost almost as if the baby sort of almost implicitly says, this is what it means to be sad. When I see a facial expression like that, is that what?
Oh,
you mean,
I'm sad.
I'm sad.
Oh, I'm sad. This is how I feel. This is what I'm showing, because this is what's being reflected.
That's not pushing them into some sort of structure. That's actually giving them the freedom to feel that.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah. Right. And so for example, if you have a mother who has, you know, sort of unresolved loss, trauma, abuse, and can't tolerate sadness, unhappiness in the baby, she's going to possibly give the baby a facial expression, she doesn't even know she's doing it, of contempt, disgust, anger, or this sort of fake smile, which is totally not matching up with what the baby's feeling. It's very confusing, and it's the beginning of sort of disorganized attachment. If the mother's expression does not accurately reflect what's going on in the baby because she can't tolerate it. When I say disorganized attachment, I'm talking about the roots of psychopathology, the roots of madness are right there in the mother's inability to reflect the baby's face back to the baby, the baby's affect.
Well, and it kind of comes back to what you were saying earlier about the implicit things that we learn along the way about our feelings, right? So if it's and kind of connects a little bit to everything's kind of important, like the facial expressions even, right?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And what's really cool to me, I love the connections. And this is kind of Michael Polanyi.
This is
tacit. So the mother indwells a particular way of being that has an impact on those around her, most importantly, her kids, her babies.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, and the babies internalize the mother.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got your mom in there in your mind and in many different forms. So she can berate you, or she can soothe you, or she can, you know, all the mothers are in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Where does dad play into this?
Dad too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dad too.
Not as much, I would imagine.
Well, it depends on how, when we talk about mothers, we're in this conversation, we're sort of using an old model, but it's really the, whoever the primary attachments are. And usually it's the mother, but more increasingly so it's the dad.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about infants, you know, first 4 to 6 months of life, often it is the mother who is the sort of primary face. She becomes the other. At first she's just a bunch of parts, you know, but she becomes sort of the first other. Yeah, whole other.
We're going to have to wrap it up in a few minutes. Are you writing a book?
No.
And if not, why not?
No, I mean, I just actually finished writing an article that's my first published academic article.
Oh, neat.
So that's kind of fun. But no, I don't know. Maybe there's a book in me when I'm
I bet there is.
90 or so.
Yeah. I hope it's before you're 90. Unless you're, you know, telling me something I don't know.
You've written books, yes?
I've published Real Change is Incremental. Mm-hmm. And then I co-edited a book on a series of essays on philosophy and theology, actually, and how they either interact or don't interact, with a friend of mine, Jason Robinson.
That's so neat.
Yeah, I hope I have a few others in me. I've got a couple things I'm working on. My problem is I just, you know, always new ideas about things to write about and start them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's really, writing is hard.
Writing is hard.
Let's talk about, come full circle about self-awareness. I think that's the worst part of it is, holy smokes, I have to share this with somebody.
Mm.
I'm not sure I'm open to that.
Yeah,
and
it's
frightening. And I think for me, I think that's really what it comes down to. And then just all the regular insecurities, you know, I think that most writers must feel, I'm sure, Blake, dealt with it too. I'm in good company.
So let me ask you one more thing.
Yes.
You talked about different modalities that you've tried in therapy.
Yes.
You haven't been on the couch four times a week on the couch, have you?
You know what? It's a very good question. I don't think so. And when you say the couch, you mean in a kind
lying of... lying down on
down
the couch.
And looking away.
Looking away,
that's
looking at the ceiling.
That's more of a Freudian perspective, correct?
Well, it's a psychoanalytic perspective.
Psychoanalytic, thank you. I'd have to think about that. Maybe with a hypnotherapist that I saw 30 years ago in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But so, full-on yeah. sort of on the couch 4 times a week psychoanalysis hasn't been something that you've tried yet.
No, I probably did a Monday, Wednesday, Friday for several mm-hmm. months, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and kind of eventually, like any kind of consistent sort of thing like that, that usually goes by the wayside at some point. Mm-hmm. And then it would be more sporadic. Oh, I'm going to go for 2 months and it'll be every Friday at 2. Mm. You know, but no, I think the short answer is no.
Okay. I can see this direct question I asked and how much anxiety
you
came
so
up.
You're so aggressive.
And you went, oh my God, oh my God.
What the hell but is she doing? I'm supposed to be interviewing her.
I'm asking you, and I'm asking your unconscious to kind of play with it,
sure.
you know, because
yeah.
it's something that can be so beneficial. Not you don't have to be mentally ill. You don't have to be unbalanced.
To
in
hear.
Fact, it's you people who are really sort of not stable enough, it's not good for them necessarily to go on the couch.
Right.
You have to be at a certain level of stability to do that. Yeah.
Well, and I think what I love about the question and what it's going to make me reflect on is that opportunity for discovery and the space and that whole idea of play.
Yeah.
Because it's a kind of play that maybe if I have been through it, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be interesting to revisit it 25 years later?
Yeah.
What I know now, how is that going to change, you know, that kind of an experience? So,
Well, it changed my life.
Yeah, I bet.
And, of course, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, no book, but you've written a... What's next? Are you working on any films? I know you're...
I'm working on the film with Beatrice on infant research and adult treatment, and I'm working on a film with my colleague and very good friend, Phyllis Ellis, about the Halibut, indigeneity and identity. It's about the Mi'kmaq people of Newfoundland and their fight to get status for the first time. Who knows what else?
Wow.
Yeah, lots of stuff coming down the pike.
A lot of things going on. Well, thanks for your time today. I'm looking forward to part three already,
Karen. What will we talk about?
I'm sure we'll find something. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.